Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. 40 million people depend on the Colorado River, one of the most important water sources in the country. Originating on the west slope of Rocky Mountain National Park, it travels over 1,400 miles through 7 U.S. states and 2 Mexican states, including cities, farmland, and tribal nations. For 17 miles, it actually forms the international boundary between Arizona and Mexico. The river also irrigates 5.5 million agricultural acres, including 15% of American agriculture and about 90% of the nation's winter vegetables, according to Utah Water Resources. But prolonged drought, climate change, and overuse have driven water levels on the Colorado and its two major reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, to historic lows. So how will climate change affect the already imperiled flow of the Colorado River? To get a better picture of this crisis and what affected states are doing to remedy the problem, we're pleased to be joined by Alex Hager, water and environment reporter covering the Colorado River Basin for KUNC Community Radio for Northern Colorado. Welcome to the program, Alex.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So, Alex, there's clearly a lot at stake with the Colorado River. A third of California drinking water comes from it. 40 million people depend on it, as I mentioned. How would you describe the current state of the river today?
Well, right now, the current state of the river is a supply-demand imbalance that has reached crisis levels. As you described, climate change is shrinking the amount of water that enters the system. A lot of that starting as snow in the states of Colorado and Wyoming. And every year, there are reasons that there is less to go around. There is less snow melting off into the places where humans divert and collect that water. And at the same time, across the Colorado River Basin, the 40 million people, as well as all of the farms and ranches and other industrial uses, they have not necessarily changed their demand in a way that is really accounting for that decrease in supply. So we have folks who are using the water based on very old rules of how much is to be allocated to, you know, each user. And those rules are not necessarily suited for the current climatological conditions. And so right now there is a lot of talk around the basin about how we are going to reduce use, but there's a lot of finger pointing between different industries, between different states, and there has been a lot of reticence to come to an agreement to reduce use across the board. So right now we are in a crisis of trying to stretch out that supply that is shrinking. There is a shrinking pie and a lot of people trying to get a slice of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like, as you say, supply is shrinking, but demand isn't really going anywhere, or it's not going down like it should with the supply decreasing. I know the river passes through multiple states, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, and of course, California. So among these states and the entities that depend on the river, which ones are the most affected right now?
Well, right now, really, everyone's affected, given that it will take, all 7 states that are involved to come to an agreement to get out of this problem. However, the largest water users tend to be agriculture in the lower basin of the Colorado River Basin. So that would be largely in Southern California and certain parts of Arizona. Like we said, you know, a lot of wintertime vegetables, leafy greens come from there, and they are typically the largest users of water. Cities have been forced to adapt rather quickly. And so we have seen the ability to conserve water in cities typically be a little more proactive. So I would say agriculture in California and Arizona is the largest user a lot of the time and typically under the most heat to use less water.
Mm-hmm. And how low today are the Colorado River water levels?
They are at record lows. When we measure the amount of water that is in those reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, or when we measure the amount of water that's in the Colorado River Basin, we're talking about the amount of water stored in Lake Powell and Lake Mead. Lake Powell, which is largely in Utah, it is a cache of water that the upper basin uses to store in the dry times and make sure that they have enough to send down to the lower basin states to meet a legal obligation to send the same amount of water down every year. And then Lake Mead, which is largely in Nevada, is used to store water for cities and farms in California and Arizona. And both of those reservoirs are at all-time lows, greatly reduced in the amount of supply they have, to the point that it's threatening the ability to generate hydropower inside some of those dams, and in the long term, threatening to not have enough water in there to keep sending down to the cities and farms that depend on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really shocking to see pictures of those two reservoirs. And I'm curious, is there any talk about potentially getting rid of one of them? I mean, if we have two and we can't fill either of them, are we entering a future where it might make sense to just go down to one that we could actually fill and then potentially rely on that one for at least more reliable hydropower, if nothing else?
Yeah, there certainly is talk about that. And which one is a matter of debate, but there are folks that say it's time to basically eradicate these components of a system that no longer work, given the way that climate change has really changed water availability. There are certainly pros and cons to both, and there are people who argue that neither should be eliminated. There are people who argue that one should be filled and the other should be eliminated, but realistically, I think that that's symbolic of how across the Colorado River Basin, people are really looking at the system as it stands in a very existential way. You know, mm-hmm. People are saying, not only do we need to make kind of small tweaks to where the water goes and how much each person gets, but we might have to take a wholesale look at the system that we built decades ago and realize that it is no longer going to work under the current conditions. And that might mean such drastic steps as scrapping this massive reservoir that's behind a massive, the Hoover Dam or the Glen Canyon Dam, these sort of icons of American industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the decreasing hydropower. So I have to follow up with you on that. If the reservoirs are not producing clean hydropower, are they being replaced by fossil fuel generating stations? Is this making the climate problem worse?
You know, I don't know a tremendous amount about that in particular, but right now we're looking at the sort of main instance of this is at the Glen Canyon Dam, which is in northern Arizona at the bottom of Lake Powell. And hydropower capacity has already been reduced there because there is just less water pressure to go through those turbines. There is a threat that water levels could drop too low to go beneath the intake for creating hydropower there, and that affects about 5 million customers. And realistically, those people would be plugged into other sources. And, given that a lot of our energy generation infrastructure in this country does come from fossil fuels, I would have to imagine that would indeed drive up some mm-hmm. fossil fuel consumption to create energy or other non-renewable resources.
And Alex, you mentioned that demand really hasn't fallen along with the supply decreases on the river. And I'm curious to know a little bit more about where that demand is coming from. Is that related to recent population growth and the growth of agriculture in these states? Is that one of the key factors you're driving the fact that demand isn't going down?
Well, the fact that population has been growing in a lot of southwestern cities that rely on the Colorado River certainly hasn't helped. But really, a lot of the focus right now is on agriculture. Between 70 and 80% of all the water used from the Colorado River goes towards agriculture, farming, and ranching. And, realistically, that is the only reason that a lot of people in this country can rely on having fresh lettuce and broccoli on their tables in December and January. But it also uses a lot of that water. In cities, they actually like to brag quite a bit about how they've been able to stretch out their water supplies, and to their credit, they largely have. Cities have been using a very finite amount of water, the same amount of water that they have counted on every year, going back decades, and they've managed to stretch that out over populations that have grown by hundreds of thousands of people in some instances. So you're seeing places that have had to create campaigns to promote water conservation, have had to go around and replace, thirsty grassy lawns with artificial turf or rock beds or some other sort of xeriscaping method. They've installed low flow shower heads and, low flush toilets and done all of these little things to reduce per capita use, so they can use the same amount of water even as their populations grow by hundreds of thousands. So because a lot of measures like that have been taken in cities, and because so much of the water is being used on farms and ranches, right now a lot of the focus is turning towards agriculture. And that industry really has a target on its back when it comes to reducing water use.
So have we not seen that same level of water conservation efficiency from agriculture that we've seen from urban water uses? And if not, why not to date?
There certainly have been some strides to make agriculture more efficient. I went and visited farms down in Yuma, Arizona, and they're really implementing a tremendous amount of technology on those farms. But largely, they have not reduced their total water use because they don't have to. There are allocations going back about 100 years that determine just how much every user, whether it's a city or a farm, will get. And that, for the most part, hasn't changed drastically. So they're entitled to a certain amount of water, and they plan to use it because it's generally quite a money-making enterprise to grow crops in a lot of these places. And because they haven't had to, they haven't really reduced their water consumption. The latest updates are that the federal government has come up with new plans to try to incentivize water reductions there. We're still waiting to see how much buy-in there is to those programs. But in a lot of cases, we're seeing the federal government use money from these new infrastructure plans. They've got billions of dollars from the Inflation Reduction Act, for example, dedicated specifically to Colorado River programs. And they are offering an incentive program where they will pay off farmers to temporarily fallow their fields in exchange for federal money. And, that will result in less water being used. That is one of the first major forays that we've seen in the last couple of years to reduce water use on some of those farms in the lower basin, but it hasn't made a substantial change yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know the Biden administration, speaking of the federal government, has been very alarmed by the conditions, particularly in the major reservoirs like Powell and Lake Mead, as you discussed. And the Biden administration has called for river basin states to cut their river water use by 25% next year or face federally mandated cuts. Can you describe a bit about what the impact of that potential policy might be?
Well, it really depends on how serious the federal government is about actually mandating those cuts. The big story this most recent summer is that the federal government came out and said, look, states, it's always going to be up to you to come up, or not always going to be, but historically, agreements about reducing water use have come between the seven states, and the federal government has had a pretty hands-off approach. But this most recent summer, they said, look, you have not come to a deal fast enough, and things are changing very rapidly to the point that some sort of reductions are needed. And so you are going to have to save 2 to 4 million acre feet of water. An acre foot is the amount of water it would take to cover 1 acre, so about the size of a football field, up to a foot deep. And they said, you need to conserve 2 to 4 million acre feet, which is a tremendous amount of water, and certainly not an amount of water that has ever been conserved in this basin in one fell swoop. And they said, you need to come up with a deal to conserve that much water, or we will do it for you. And they give them a 60-day deadline to do it. Now, the states did not come to a deal. There was a lot of finger pointing from one region of the basin to another that said, we think you should be the first to conserve. There was some consternation among whether it should fall on agriculture or on cities. But at the end of the day, they didn't come to a deal after that 60-day window. And the federal government did not have any repercussions for that. The Department of the Interior, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, which is the main federal agency that manages the dams and reservoirs in the Colorado River system, they did not come out and impose mandatory conservation restrictions. So it stands to be seen whether they are going to be willing to do that in the future. They did have some actions. They did implement some kind of relatively small cutbacks that were part of these previously agreed upon rules for managing the river. They did come out with that program to incentivize conservation on farms, but they did not say we are forcing people to use less water. And it stands to be seen whether they will do that in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Calls One Planet series. We're discussing the Colorado River during an era of climate change, worsening drought, how the river is faring, and what the policy response may or may not be. We're very pleased to be joined by Alex Hager, water and environment reporter covering the Colorado River Basin for KUNC, community radio for Northern Colorado. But you can join our conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear from you if you visited the Colorado recently and have some observations. If you have ideas for what you think might be able to be done to help us conserve this precious water source, we'd love to hear from you. Again, 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Alex, I wanted to ask about tribes. We haven't really talked about that so much, and we know states and federal governments definitely affected, but 29 federally recognized tribes also depend on this water. Are there different legal rights to the Colorado River water among these Native American tribes?
Yeah, tribes are incredibly important, but historically excluded in the Colorado River Basin. They are some of the first and most significant users of water in the Colorado River Basin. But going back to the earliest days of the U.S. government, of state governments, of white people managing water in this region, they have not been at the table to be part of these agreements. And even with that, they do actually have some of the largest allocations of water, but a lot of times because these tribes are fairly underfunded and don't have a lot of industry or a lot of homes hooked up to the pipes, they do not necessarily have the capacity to use all of that water. So right now, they are asking for a bigger voice at the table, for more money to help build the infrastructure to allow them to use that water in their homes and to participate in agriculture and, be able to see some of the economic benefits that they could have from utilizing all of the water that they are allowed to use. At every juncture, tribes have come out and said that they don't feel like they're adequately represented. In this deal that I was talking about from this most recent summer, when the federal government came to the states, tribes had already been asking for years for more of a voice in these discussions. And they said, look, we have heard, a lot of talk from states and from other government entities saying that it's time to include tribes. But here was a test of that, and we felt like we were left in the dark. So the next major discussions about how the water will be managed in the Colorado River Basin are due to be wrapped up by 2026. There is a major portion of the current rules will expire in 2026. So before then, the seven states in the basin are due to redraw the guidelines for how the water is shared. And they're saying this is the chance to include the tribes. And the level to which they're going to be included sort of remains to be seen. But they are a significant player here, and they are asking for representation that reflects that.
Mm-hmm. Well, 2026 then may be a big year, but actually 1922 seems to be the sort of root of some of the challenges here. You referenced an agreement among these multiple states that dates back 100 years. So it actually was almost exactly 100 years ago, November 24th, 1922, with seven men from Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming all signed their names to a four-page document that we call the Colorado River Compact. And subsequent agreements that came to be known as the Law of the River have really determined the fate of pretty much every drop of water that flows through the Southwest through this river. Can you talk a bit about this agreement, what its challenges and flaws are, and what the talk is now about trying to update it?
Basically, this agreement was written under very different climatological conditions. It was written in a world where there was a lot more water to go around, and it was written in a world where there were far fewer people and farms depending on it. And so because of that, it has been tweaked a little bit here and there, but largely to stave off catastrophe. It has not been rewritten, but there have been sort of a patchwork of short-term measures to try to kick the ball down the road. Recently, that ball has been kicked towards 2026. A lot of the measures have just been to sort of tide things over until this big seven-state redraw of the rules. But realistically, the compact worked for a while, but does not work in the reality of climate change. We are currently in the midst of a 23-year drought, a mega drought, as it's been called. It is the worst drought to hit this region of the country in 1,800 years. They've done research on tree rings, cross sections of trees from before a lot of recorded history, and they've seen that this is the worst drought we've had in nearly two millennia. And so because of that, there's just a lot less water to go around, and certainly less water than there was to go around when they originally wrote those rules.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we have a caller, Greg from Palo Alto, calling in with a question. Greg, welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you. I'll just say that I'm wondering if this drought continues, and I see no reason to think that it's not going to continue, or even if there was a deluge for how many years, I don't know what it would take to replenish both Lake Mead and Lake Powell. But, you know, areas like Tucson, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Diego, I don't know where they're going to get their water if this drought continues. They're going to be forced, kicking and screaming, to come up with some plan, as well as agriculture. You can't give farming water as we do here in Northern California to grow almonds, but get shipped abroad. So it seems to me that there's going to have to be some drastic changes in the way these large metropolitan areas and farming communities handle water. I mean, it's going to have to be imposed. I don't know. I guess it's just going to get to the point where it's going to have to be so bad that people have no option.
Greg, you raise an important point. Is crisis going to be the only thing that really leads to any change? Alex, what do you make of Greg's observation here that it may take a crisis to see the kind of major action that may be required to deal with this ongoing drought situation in the river?
Yeah, Greg, I appreciate you calling in and putting forth some of those ideas. I would say that this is pretty close to a crisis. We have yet to see whether that will actually force the stakeholders involved to come up with a solution. I will say one thing is that, I know when I first started this beat, I held the belief that a lot of folks do that, you know, we might run out of water in the immediate future. And that's not necessarily the case, especially in cities. I think a lot of places in some of the driest parts of the country have water banked up to last at least, you know, if you turned off the taps tomorrow, a lot of places in Arizona would have enough water banked up to last 5 to 10 years. And given that there's really no plans of turning the water off tomorrow, they're going to be able to last even longer than that. But realistically, I think it's going to come down to the willingness from states to compromise and the willingness from states to cut into agriculture. Cities are often the most visible use of water, I think, because all of us living in the southwestern U.S. can think about watering lawns and can see our neighbors watering their lawns, or think about the length of our showers or the amount we use washing our dishes. But realistically, just with 70 to 80% of that water being used on farms and ranches, that's where it's going to have to come from. There certainly is slack in the system. There, you could cut into water use in agriculture and make sure that taps stay flowing in cities, but it will depend on the willingness of policymakers to do that. And it will also have tremendous consequences. You will see agricultural communities go dry. You will see places that have had a strong history of farming maybe have to abandon some of that. You will see prices of goods grown with water from the Colorado River go up. I mean, there's no way we can get out of this without pretty significant changes in some way or another. And whether those are levied on prices at the grocery store, whether those are levied on rules about, how you're allowed to grow the plants outside of your home, we'll see. But it's not going to be the end of life in the Southwest, but it may mean some substantial changes to life as we know it.
So some dramatic restructuring may be in store. Well, we've got a lot more to talk about the Colorado River here on Your Calls One Planet series. So we'll be back with Alex Hager, water and environment reporter covering the Colorado River Basin for KUNC just after this short break. Those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We are podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or leave your comments on our website, yourcallradio.org. Well, today we are discussing and going to continue to discuss for another 10 minutes the state of the Colorado River. We're pleased to be joined by Alex Hager, water and environment reporter covering the Colorado River Basin for KUNC. And we do want to hear from you if you have thoughts about what should be done to conserve water, to preserve the environment and the Colorado River. The number again, 866-798-TALK. Well, Alex, let's talk about the impact on endangered species, on habitats, ecosystem of the Colorado River. This drought affects not just the humans who live and grow food and all of that along the watershed there, but what is the current state right now for the environment, for the ecosystem of the Colorado River?
There's a lot of ways, I think, in which reduced water supply is changing habitats as we know them and is leading to problems for some of the species that live within it. I think this is happening in a lot of kind of small ways. We are seeing not necessarily major redraws of where things can live because of the water supply, but because animals have become dependent on where humans have put the water, when those human reservoirs and rivers that we use to carry water from one place to another start to dry up, we're starting to see changes in what's able to live there. One example is at the Glen Canyon Dam. As we've seen water levels drop, there are fish in Lake Powell that previously have not been below the dam. But now, because water levels are dropping, the water in which they are able to live is now closer to the pass-through in the dam, and they can now go downstream where they hadn't previously been and predate on animals that were native and previously unthreatened. Another thing is less that the Colorado River Basin drought is impacting animals in the same way that it's impacting humans, but just the fact that there is less rain and snow falling from the sky is changing the landscapes in the headwaters a little bit. We are seeing drier soil. We're seeing drier forests that are more liable to catch on fire. And so a lot of those places where the Colorado River starts are seeing more wildfires. And that means the destruction of habitat for some creatures. And it means making some places uninhabitable for years after those wildfires.
Mm-hmm. I'd imagine also a lot more sediment and runoff potentially in the river from charred out forests. What about invasive species? I know there's a smallmouth bass, a voracious predator that is now potentially decimating some of the native fish. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was just mentioning at the Glen Canyon Dam. They have smallmouth bass that are, I think, a lot of times pretty appealing to catch if you are an angler in Lake Powell. And basically, they only live at a certain elevation below the surface of the water, at a certain point in the water column. Now, typically, that had been pretty high in the lake. But now, because the lake itself is dropping, the point in which they can live is getting closer to the bottom of the lake and closer to the intake at which water passes through the dam from Lake Powell down to the section of Colorado River beneath it. So those fish are able to swim through the dam and enter a particular section of the Colorado River where they had not previously lived, and they are able to predate on the humpback chub, which is a native species that had lived there before and was not previously under threat of smallmouth bass. But because of the changing conditions in the lake above, they now have to deal with a new predator.
I see. Thank you for explaining. I didn't realize that was the fish that you were talking about at the lower levels of the reservoir level. Well, let's talk about solutions. We've got about 5 minutes left here. So let's start with agriculture. That was something we talked about right before the break. What are some of the solutions that you think might be viable to really get the agricultural users along the river to be much more efficient with the water that is available and is likely going to be available going forward?
At this point, I think a lot of places are running quite efficient operations because it makes sense for them to stretch out their water supplies. But I do think that the solutions we're going to see are going to be policy-based. It's going to be states agreeing to distribute less water. And it is going to force maybe reduced agricultural activity. It is going to force cities to stretch out their water supplies further. But I don't think there are going to be scientific ways in which we can get around this issue broadly. It is going to be policy measures that are going to reduce the amount of water sent to people who are using a lot.
Mm-hmm. And what about other solutions on the urban side? It sounds like it's already fairly fairly efficient. That's maybe one of the bright spots here for urban water users. But is there more that could be done there?
Yeah, urban water use has actually been one of the sort of bright spots of conservation in that a lot of cities, including some very notable dry cities, Las Vegas, for example, has done an incredible job of stretching out a relatively small water supply as that area has grown quite a bit. One other thing I want to bring up is that there are a lot of sort of quick and easy solutions that are proposed around here. I know some folks may have heard of cloud seeding, for example, the idea of putting more clouds in the sky and dropping more snow high in the mountains where the Colorado River starts, or desalination, taking ocean water, pulling the salt out of it, and making it drinkable to pump it into city pipes. These are all part of the solution, but not one of them is going to be the silver bullet. There are a lot of different kind of ideas that are suggested to augment the water supply, and realistically, they will all maybe help top things up a little bit, but all of them are incredibly expensive. Some of them are quite scientifically complicated, and we can't just switch on a lot more clouds, switch on the use of ocean water, and pull ourselves out of this trouble. They're going to be able to help certain communities locally, but they are not going to solve the problem. So realistically, we will see more of that, but we will also need to see broad policy changes and reductions to the amount of water sent to largely farms, but also cities, if we really want to get out of this crisis.
And Alex, where do you think those policy changes are going to come from? Is that going to be from the federal government putting pressure, like we just talked about with the Biden administration? Or is it going to have to be up to these states to lead, or some leaders among the states involved to actually take the steps necessary for these reforms to go into place?
That's a question for the states. I mean, up until now, the impetus has entirely been on those seven states that use water from the Colorado River to come up with plans to reduce use. But they talk a big talk about collaboration. And then when it comes time to make decisions, a lot of times we'll resort to finger pointing and won't make much progress on actually coming to a deal. It really does remain to be seen how much the federal government's willing to step in. They have historically been quite hands off. But this is, you know, I mean, you can say as many times as you want, but it's still true. These are unprecedented times. And that is certainly true for the supply-demand imbalance in the Colorado River Basin. And it may lead to unprecedented decisions for the federal government to come in and mandate changes that the states have not yet been willing to make.
And Alex, I know this is really your beat covering the Colorado River here. What are some of the big indicators that you're looking at or maybe keeping in mind that might indicate to the rest of us that there might be some political breakthroughs here? Are there key moments coming up that you're watching out for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the big deadline that everyone has their eye on is the year 2026. That is when the current guidelines for managing the river expire. In about the year to year and a half before that, we are likely to see states having some pretty serious discussions, trying to reach some compromise about how to reduce water use. So before 2026, that is the big milestone. But there's also a lot of other ones along the way. Typically, the big releases about this kind of thing come during the summer. That's when we see the federal government modifying how much water is released from the reservoirs to downstream communities. It's when we see kind of patchwork proposals to conserve a little bit here and there. But one thing I will have my eye on, and an event that I will be attending, is coming up in just a few weeks here in Las Vegas. It's the Colorado River Water Users Association annual meeting. It's a meeting that's been going on for decades, but it has certainly had some increased importance and some increased national and even international attention. It will be in Las Vegas in 2 weekends as all of the most important people in Colorado River management get together in one room and do sort of a status check-in on how things are going. And right now, they're going to be forced to do a bit of reckoning on the fact that things are not going well.
So what's going to happen in Vegas is definitely not going to stay in Vegas, because this is an issue that affects so many Americans,
yes,
so many states. But Alex Hager, water and environment reporter covering the Colorado River Basin for KUNC, Community Radio for Northern Colorado, thank you so much for coming on and explaining this complicated ecosystem, both politically and environmentally, for our listeners. We really appreciate it.
I really appreciate you having me. You can check out more of our work at KUNC.org.
Right. And we'll make sure we have a link for that up on our website. Thank you so much, Alex.